supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we're going to double up on the question of the week. We're going to talk about what to do when roots invade your compost bin. And because of the specific type of root, we're also going to talk about how to layer plants to propagate new ones from old. But despite all that valuable information, it's still a phone call show, cats and kittens. So we're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, hello.
Hey, Mike, how are you, man?
All right.
And where is Mike all right?
I'm calling from Goldsboro, North Carolina. I'm a native of the South Jersey area, but I'm stationed down here at the Air Force Base.
Oh, very good. Very good. Thank you. What are you doing?
Well, in the military,
yeah.
I'm a weapons loader. I guess put the bombs on the fighter airplanes.
Woo, don't drop any. cut back on the coffee, Mike.
Yeah.
You don't want to be shaky when you do that. Well, thank you for the work you do. What can we do for you?
I have a question. I recently bought a house here. It's a fairly newer house. It was built in 2008. The grass, though, is still like a contractor grass,
mm-hmm.
and this summer I want to prepare it and get it ready for a real grass, and I think I'm going to do like a Bermuda, but now I can notice the grass is getting dormant right now, and there's lots of weeds in the yard, so what I'm asking is, what can I do to take care of all the weeds and get it ready for this spring for some real grass?
Well, you're in an interesting situation. When you used to listen to the show in South Jersey, we used to talk a lot about cool season grasses, bluegrass and fescue, and how you just, for instance, if you were working with one of those grasses, you just would have missed the time to really spruce up your lawn. But you are installing a warm season grass, and because your current lawn is going dormant, you know it already was a warm season grass. So that's the odds are that it's going to do really well in your area. And I think people get all too fixated on weeds. Weeds aren't that strong unless lawn owners give them the upper hand. So in the spring, and you'll work this out with your local either county extension agent, or you're going to find a good local lawn care supplier who you trust, a big garden center. And have you settled on Bermuda grass?
I think I'm going to go with Bermuda because my neighbor currently has Bermuda, and I think it would be better to just continue on what he has going on across the way.
Oh, okay. Now, are your lawns adjacent? Do they touch?
Yes.
That's excellent. You know, if you do nothing, man, his Bermuda will eventually take over your lawn in a couple of years.
That's what he said. That's what's kind of happening already.
Excellent. Excellent. So I'm so glad you told me this. Job number one is identify exactly what kind of Bermuda he has. Because Bermuda is just a basic type. It's like saying tomato. So find out what Bermuda grass he used. It's unlikely he sowed it by seed, but he could have. More than likely, he bought sod that he cut apart or put plugs in the soil or something like that. He may be able to tell you the, quote, brand name. Grasses have, you know, like Rebel 2 Mustang or Bermuda Extra Improved 137, something like that. And then find out where he got it. And then you match it up perfectly, and his lawn looks nice, right?
Yes, yes.
So find out exactly how he installed it. Maybe lean on him for a little bit of help. You've got the best thing in the world. You've got a next-door neighbor who already knows how to take care of this stuff. And, you know, you're going to till up what you have. Don't worry about the weeds so much. Just rake away as much of the old green as you can. get a nice load of topsoil or high-quality compost delivered to make a good, quote, seed bed, and then install the grass as the weather's warming up and as his grass is coming out of dormancy, install yours exactly the way he did his. Pretty much care for it exactly the same way. And then warm season grasses are cut shorter, typically, than cool season grasses. So you'll be like at a 2.5 to 3 inch cut. And they are fed during the growing season. You would kill a cool season grass by feeding it in the summer, but that's when your Bermuda grass is going to want to be fed, 2 or 3 feedings over the summer. And as you know, in the fall, it's going to go tan and dormant, and in the spring, it will green up again. But it is a great grass choice for there, and you're made in the shade because all you got to do, it's like sitting in a restaurant. It's like the old restaurant joke, I'll have what he's having.
Okay.
All right?
All right, sir.
Piece of cake, can of corn, easiest thing you can do. All right, Mike, good luck.
All right, thanks, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jit, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Now, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Jit, that's correct.
Oh, okay. And what's the derivation here?
It's Concetta, but when my mother called me in the Italian, she would call me Congettina. So the Jit came in the Congettina.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very
thank
good.
Thank you.
And where are you?
Paoli.
Oh, okay. Paoli, Pennsylvania, just
correct.
Outside of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What can we do for Jit?
Well, Mike, I have a lilac tree that I transferred in 2006. And before I transferred it, it had blooms all the time. It was gorgeous. I transferred it from Villanova to Paoli. Mm. So it's been here 2006, and it's still beautiful, but not one plant, not one flower has ever come out. And I just don't know what to do. I've cut it back, and I even fed it. But I don't have one bloom.
Well, it's mean. I mean, it's mad at you. You know, how dare you? It was doing fine. It was one of these rare lilacs that bloomed, and you had to seize defeat.
I know, but it was a gift to me from my mother, and I didn't want to leave it.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Okay. Now, does it get good sun in its current loop?
Lots of afternoon sun only, but lots of it.
Mm. Yeah, but, you know, these are drama queens. This is one of the top three drama queens in the garden, and they really like morning sun.
They?
Yeah. How late in the afternoon does this sun show up?
It's in the summertime. Well, spring, it starts about 1:30.
Yeah.
And it doesn't stop until almost 5:30.
That could, you know, I'm sorry. That could be one of the issues here.
Do you think it would hurt if I transferred it in a sunnier place?
You did it once and it didn't die, right?
Right.
Well, maybe third time would be the charm, and this would be the time to do it when it's dormant or first thing in the spring.
Okay.
Now you've talked about feeding it and pruning it. Those could be deadly. What did you feed it with?
What is it, Miracle-Grow?
Yeah, don't do that again. That's a that's a chemical plant food. And lilacs especially are very sensitive to the salts, the chemical salts these things put into the soil. They also tend to be a little bit too high in nitrogen, which can inhibit flowering. You see the best lilacs are at abandoned farmhouses, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Where you drive by and you can't see the house anymore. You just see this giant purple covering over top of it. And you know nobody's been feeding that puppy.
It's funny you should say that because I have two others and they're in full sun from morning till evening and they do beautifully.
Yeah, see, I think that's it. A lot of times, you know, it seems very basic, but when a big plant like this is not flowering, the issue is often just lack of just enough sunlight. And boy, if there's anything that can be possibly be wrong, a lilac is going to seize on it.
Okay.
And now, when are you pruning these things?
I didn't prune it this year, but I pruned it last year about November of 2012.
Oh. Well, that would have destroyed any blooms.
Oh, really?
Yes. You know, it's a spring blooming plant.
Uh-huh.
So, for instance, if you go around your landscape, I'm just going to name the basic things that almost everybody has that are good examples. If you go up to a big rhododendron or an azalea, and you look closely on the azalea, you'll see there's little flower buds already formed in the centers of the leaf axils. Now, the rhododendron, you can see those from 50 feet away. The, you know, the buds are so big. It seems counterintuitive that the flowers would form under this thin bark and then remain there all winter exposed to the elements, but that's how spring bloomers work. So the only safe time to prune things like azaleas, rhododendrons, and lilacs is right after they finish blooming in the spring. You know, for instance, if you wanted to prune yours for stimulation to try to coax bloom out of it in future years and it wasn't blooming, you would prune it when you pruned the others.
Okay.
To deadhead the flowers. I hope you didn't prune those in the fall either.
No, I didn't.
But they're crazy plants. It normally I try to deter people from moving plants around, but you've done this once before. If you can move it to a sunnier spot, and again, only prune it right after blooming time, I think you'll have three blooming lilacs.
Oh, good. Well, I'll do that. Thanks, Mike. Thank you so much for your help. I love your show.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope you have three lilacs in a row in a couple of years.
Okay.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that we still have a few openings left in the tour I'll be leading to investigate the botanical delights of Cuba and just maybe enjoy their 80-degree daytime winter temperatures from January 14th to the 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls, how to have non-rooty compost, and how to make new plants out of old with simple layering. I'm Simple Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we got an email about a guy who has roots invading his compost pile. It's a common problem, but the plant that's invading his compost is not commonly the cause. It's a forsythia. So we're going to tell you some interesting facts about forsythia and how you can propagate them the easiest way known in the horticultural world, and how to get those roots out of the bottom of your compost pile. In the meantime, lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I am doing very well, Joe. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine.
And where is Joe doing fine?
Manistique, Michigan. It's in the Upper Peninsula.
Okay, so you're already got the snow tires on and you've been skiing a couple of weekends, you know?
Not enough snow to ski, but just enough to tease you.
Yeah, exactly. Aren't you in one of the snowiest regions in the country?
It is one of the snowiest regions, but where I live, they call it the Banana Belt because I live right on northern Lake Michigan, and it kind of keeps the snow away from us. Now, you get 10 or 15 miles inland or closer to Lake Superior, you get pounded with tons of snow.
All right. What can we do for Joe in a cold and dangerous part of Michigan?
Okay. What my wife and I have done is we've purchased 10 acres. It's a combination of hardwoods and coniferous. And in this 10 acres, we have two pastures that total about 2 to 3 acres that are overgrown with weeds.
Right.
And we would like to turn it back into pasture to feed animals because we want to start a hobby farm and then eventually build a house and move out there.
I guess we're talking about grass-fed cattle and chickens, pastured chickens?
We're talking about chickens and a couple of dairy cows, some dairy goats, and possibly some alpacas.
Get the goats right away, baby, and turn them loose in the pasture. The goats will eat your weeds.
Okay.
So that is the easiest, the most ecologically sound, and the most productive way to get rid of the weeds. We did, I forget if it was an interview or a question of the week earlier in the year about using goats for this very purpose. And just in the last couple of shows, we had an interview with people who were using a very specific breed of sheep that eats bigger plants than most sheep. You know, most sheep are just grass eaters. They'd want to come in after you got everything all nice and cleaned up for them. But there's this breed of sheep that eats big woody plants. So if this is where you're going, then I think the smart money is to do, I've never thought of it this way, kind of succession grazing, succession farming. Instead of following one plant with another, I think it would be very smart of you to follow your main animals with these kind of pioneer animals. Sheep and goats will clear that area probably better than any herbicide, any mechanical thing. They're going to drop some, you know, natural fertilizer down on the ground. So I would give them all next spring and summer to get the weeds under control. And then right around early August, mid-August, then I would go through and sow your pasture grass.
Okay.
And before you do that, though, now, have you acquired the services of a large animal vet?
We have not.
Okay. It is much better to engage the services of a vet before you even choose your animals than it is
right
after the fact. It sounds like a kind of an area where you're going to have a lot of those kind of resources. So this is the time for you, while you got your sheep and your goats clearing the area, this is the time to sit down with a vet, tell them your plans. They may wish to suggest different breeds of cattle, for instance, that
okay
are more suited to your area up there, to the winters especially, I would think, but also for your eventual use of them. And then they will be very specific about the types of pasture grass that are correct, and they will also give you a list of the weeds that are dangerous,
okay,
although that applies more to horses than it does to cattle. But I think you got a plan. As soon as you said goats, ding, 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 everything fell into place. Get the goats out there right away. You know, keep them fenced in. Make sure they're protected from any big predators you have out there. And maybe think about getting some sheep in there. And I would think by the time it comes, you would seed the pasture in the late summer. By the
right
time that comes, you'll have a much cleaner area, and you will have professional information on the varieties of pasture grasses you should be sowing.
Okay. That sounds excellent.
If you can, the ultimate goal would be to have the goats and the sheep get the noxious weeds under control, bring in a big load of well-composted horse manure or nice topsoil or compost or a mixture of the two. And then so your pasture seed right in that, so you're not bringing up new weeds. Then you'd be starting with a clean slate.
That makes all sense in the world. Never thought of that.
Well,
I appreciate it, Mike.
You should do some research on no-till farming. A lot of times tilling is the worst enemy of a farmer.
Right.
All right, Joe?
I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
All right. Good luck, and you stay warm this winter.
I'm going to try.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care, man.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joanna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
How are you, Joanna?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing just fine, thank you. And where is Joanna Good?
I am in Mercerville, New Jersey.
Right, which is just outside of Philadelphia, just across the bridge.
Yes, we're like 45 minutes.
What can we do for Joanna in Mercerville?
My husband gave me as an anniversary present a fig tree. And I have no idea what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It lost all the leaves. It has only one leaf left.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's getting some figs, some little tiny figs, which I don't know what to do. It's outside on a planter, but I don't know if to bring it inside. I have no idea what to do with it.
Okay. So it's in a pot.
Yes.
Sometimes if you have the ideal situation, you can put the pot in a cool basement, a place that drops down to like 40 degrees but doesn't freeze. Do you have a situation like that?
Yes, we have a basement or we have a sunroom.
Well, the sunroom would not get cool, though.
It will get a little bit cool. It gets a little bit cool.
Not 40 degrees.
Well, no. Yeah, no.
Yeah. See, these plants want to go through dormancy. They don't, you know, although the ficus plant, the office house plant, is technically a fig. But if you want bearing figs, you want to get it into the ground eventually. Now, I'm curious, when did you receive it?
September.
And what did you do to it?
Nothing.
Nothing? Why did it drop its leaves?
I have no idea. I think because it's fall and everything is falling, so I guess, I don't know.
And how tiny are these figs?
They are tiny. They are like a rice grain.
Oh, okay. So they're not going to go anywhere. They're not going to do anything.
Okay.
Now, you do wish to grow this outside, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. And I don't know if I can grow it outside, if I can plant it outside, or if I leave it in the pot where it is.
No. I think we want to get it into the ground. This is a great time of year to put a fig tree in the ground.
Now, oh, is it?
Now, do you have a protected area that's like in a corner of your house where it'd be shielded from the wind and everything like that?
Yes.
Okay. So you want to take it out of its pot. You want to dig a nice hole,
yes.
And then you want to drop it into the ground and try to keep the trunk of the plant at the same height of the relationship to the soil that it was in the pot.
I see.
And then spread some compost or, you know, something like that over the surface of the soil, but don't use any wood mulch.
Okay.
And then you say this thing is tiny. How tiny is it?
Not that tiny, maybe 10 inches.
That's pretty tiny. That's pretty tiny. Did you ever have deer walking right up to your house and eating your plants?
No, because we have the backyard is all gated. So
oh, good,
no.
good. So what I want you to do is, after you plant it, get a couple of stakes and drive the stakes into the ground about a foot away from the plant, and then wrap burlap around the stakes.
Okay.
And drop a piece of burlap over the top as well.
Okay.
And that will protect it from the worst of winter. In the spring, you will see the plant start to green up with lots of new growth.
Yes.
That's when you get out there with a pair of pruners, you take a good look at it, and you figure out what parts may have been damaged by winter. Do any look black? Do they look broken? Do they look dead?
Okay.
And you will prune those parts off. But you'll also remove the burlap and you can take the stakes out of the ground. You can leave them in, whatever works for you.
Yeah.
And then you'll just let the plant grow. It really doesn't need to. You can shovel some compost under it. That would be the perfect food for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it would not be impossible for you to get figs to eat at the end of next summer.
Okay.
But then you repeat the whole sequence. Don't prune it in the fall. Just wrap it with the burlap again. You know, if it's gotten too big, just wrap the bottom part. You know, try to throw some burlap over the top. And then that following spring, you do the same thing, pruning off any areas that winter killed. And by year three, at the end of the summer, you're going to be eating figs.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. I hope you're eating figs in a couple of years.
I hope I will send you some in a couple of years.
There you go. We'll make some Fig Newtons.
Yes. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. You take care
now. Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. How are you doing today?
I am doing just fine. Thank you. David, how are you, sir?
Fantastic, thank you.
And where is David Fantastic?
At the moment, I'm on the road in Tennessee, but I live in just outside of Greenville, South Carolina.
Oh, a little bit of heaven down there. That's a nice warm spot in the country, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Fantastic weather.
What can we do for David, who drives back and forth but makes his home in Greenville?
I'm in the process of purchasing a home that is in an area of Greenville that's well known for its large oak trees.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an existing driveway, but I plan on taking the driveway out and moving it over, which is actually going to place the driveway between several large oak trees. And the driveway will actually come pretty close to some of the oak trees. I'd say probably within 3 feet.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure I don't damage the root system of those large oaks to where it weakens them. I end up having a problem later on, the trees falling down on my house or any of the other houses maybe close by. So I was wondering if you can give me some idea on what exactly I need to do there.
Okay, just riddle me this, Batman. Why does the driveway need to be moved?
Because the property is actually shared with two homes, and once I purchase the property, that'll eliminate them from actually using that part of the driveway, which I can actually turn into part of my front yard.
Okay, so you want to restore the old driveway to a garden area and build yourself a new driveway.
That's exactly right.
You're sure, though?
Oh, I'm positive.
Okay. What material are you thinking of using?
Well, right now I was just going to throw down some crush and run. Until I actually decided what I needed to use.
So you mean you're just going to make a gravel driveway?
That's correct.
Huh, okay. And for the crushed rock, the crushed gravel, you're looking at this as being temporary?
Probably temporary, and more than likely I'll probably end up actually putting some sort of asphalt.
Okay. And how wide? Are there any zonal restrictions? Is there anybody telling you how wide this driveway has to be, what the minimum is or anything?
No, sir, not at all.
Well,
the existing driveway is probably about, I'd say, maybe 10 foot wide.
Yeah, that's
8 foot to 10 foot wide.
That's pretty standard. The second biggest cause, human cause of plant death, is soil compaction. Now, are these trees, do they have nice surface roots? Do they have, like, root flares showing up above ground?
Yes.
Okay. You know, the answer here is that you won't know until you do it. Here's what I'm thinking. What I would do, and this is just a crazy thought, is before you lay the gravel, I might core aerate the root that you're going to lay the gravel onto where you're going to do the driveway so that we get good drainage underneath the stones. I know the stones themselves provide good drainage. I would get a core aerator and run it up and down this area of driveway, lay it out with stones, and drive down the center. In truth, there's probably a longer, long-term danger to trees when really heavy mowing equipment is used around them many times a season, all season long. So I think you're driving down a little alley is not going to damage them at all. What you want to do is don't do anything for them other than make sure that this area doesn't pool water. You're going to compact this area, especially if it's clay, with your cars. So that's why I want you to do a real good core aeration first. Improve the drainage in that area. And the core aerator machine will pull out little plugs. I want you to get the plugs out of there and pile them up somewhere in your property where they'll compost down. I want to keep those holes in the ground. And then you lay your stone. And other than that, I certainly don't want you to feed your trees or mulch your trees or give them any kind of injections or anything like that. And use common sense, and I think you're going to be fine.
Well, that sounds good. I was kind of thinking that way, but I'll tell you, I'm a first-time listener, and I've learned just tons and tons of things. I'm going to continue to listen, so you've got a great thing, and I certainly appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David. That's very nice of you. Good luck with your project, man.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn homeowners with cool season lawns that the window for feeding their turf is rapidly closing and that spreading fertilizer too late in the season may be illegal in their area. That's right. The state of Maryland has recently joined New York, New Jersey, and several other states that regulate the types of fertilizers that can be used on lawns, their potency, and the timing of their application. And many of those states prohibit feeding after November 15th, when it becomes too cold for the fertilizer to do any good anyway. But don't you go searching for your state laws just yet, because we'll be right back with what to do when roots invade your compost pile, how to layer plants like forsythia and spirea, and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. What to do when roots invade your compost pile? And because our specific questioner mentioned forsythia, we'll tell you a little trick with forsythia that can help you create new plants to give away or move around your property. Works with a lot of other plants, too. You won't want to miss it. And you won't. It's coming up after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Larry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Good. Where is Larry good?
New Tripoli, Pennsylvania.
What can we do for Larry in New Tripoli?
we bought a set of kiwi plants, Mr. Kiwi and a Mrs. Kiwi plant, because we wanted to have kiwis, obviously, as a fruit crop, but we have not been able to see any flowers or any fruit or anything at all from our kiwi plants.
No flowers?
Yeah, no, nothing. We moved here from Northern California. We had friends with kiwi plants that had wonderful luck with them, and we were down there Topton buying our favorite varietals the spring of 2012, and we saw these kiwi plants that were in great shape. They were 4 or 5 feet long, so we put them in the ground, and they've been growing wonderfully. They look great, and they're climbing and expanding their territory, but we're not seeing any fruit on either plant.
Well, fruit bothers me less than a lack of flowers. Now, you bought these plants locally in Pennsylvania, near where you live.
Correct.
And they were identified as hardy kiwi.
Yes. Okay. And they have survived the winters just fine.
How long have they been in the ground? And what time of year did you put these puppies in the ground?
We put them in the ground in spring last year. They had already, you know, they were not obviously mature plants, but the canes on them were 4 or 5 feet tall already when we put them in the ground. We put them in the ground in spring 2012. So
they've
had 2 summers, and we're going into a second winter.
Okay. I think the news is good. That's totally reasonable for a fruiting plant. These plants, you know, typically need some time to get established, and then after they get established, they'll produce a lot of little fruits that'll feed the birds and the squirrels instead of you. Now, are they getting good sun?
Yes. The one has southeast exposure. The other one has full south exposure.
Okay.
And I would say partial sun, not full sun.
Okay. This is interesting now.
The reason that they have, I would say, partial is that we have a deck which comes off of our second story home. So the deck is serving as the arbor for this.
Right.
And because obviously it's a deck, it does throw some shade on those plants for part of the day.
Approximately how many hours of sun hit the leaves of these plants a day?
They're getting full sun for 8 or 9 hours a day.
No problem. And have you fed them anything?
Not particularly. It's in good soil. I follow your advice for compost and stuff.
Oh, okay, good. Well, compost actually counts as food. And have you mulched them with anything?
Not this fall yet, no.
What does that mean?
It means I mulch and put compost in my garden and in my flower beds in the early summer to feed my gardens and stuff, but I have not done anything since then.
Oh, okay, good, 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 good. I think you're fine, man. Plus, I also think this is the time where you're going to start to learn how to prune these plants.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask.
In the dormant period, when you don't want to go outside, in like January and February, you're going to remove some branches. It's gotten to be a little bit of a tangle already, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's getting pretty leggy.
You're going to remove some branches that are like crossing each other, getting each other's way. You're going to cut back some of the longer branches. But the fruits and flowers form on the previous year's wood frequently. Sometimes they'll form on the new wood, but sometimes they'll form on old wood. So make sure that you shorten most of the branches rather than remove them. Now, if there's a branch that's obviously in the way, you cut it all the way back. And you can either do this while the plant is completely dormant or right when it begins to grow again in the spring. This will really move it along and help improve the fruitfulness. There are plants that really need a nice yearly pruning to have that stimulation to produce fruit. There's like an enzyme thing going on there. So pruning really is the missing piece, but you haven't missed it yet. You're right on the money. This is the first year you should be pruning these plants back, and you should start to get a little bit of fruit this coming summer. But it really, honestly, it'll be the year after that where you're going to start seeing if you really get anything good from these things.
Great.
Don't be afraid to go online and go to the Pennsylvania State Extension System and look at a couple of bulletins on pruning hardy kiwi. There'll be illustrations. They'll give you really good advice. You don't have to try to remember what I just said.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Larry.
Thanks.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I am doing well, Richard. How are you, sir?
I'm doing wonderfully.
And where is Richard wonderful?
I am in Upper East Tennessee in Bristol.
Oh, in the Tri-Cities area.
Yes.
Very good. I know your growing area very well. I made a couple of trips down there. We have a great station that we're on the air down there.
WETS.
Oh,
Johnson
right.
City.
Yeah, from that Tri-Cities area. All right, what can we do for Richard in Bristol?
Well, I have a question about my pear trees.
Okay.
My wife and I moved into a house about a year ago, and the previous owner had planted pears everywhere, and I have 6 pear trees. And probably about, from what I can tell from this year's crop, 3 different varieties. One of the trees is in the shade and drip line of another, and a second tree has been broken out from an ice storm.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, if I were to take out a couple of these trees, would that affect the gene pool of the pears that I had left? And is that going to affect the taste of the fruit or the yield?
So Richard knows that with fruit trees, the more trees you have, the more fruit you get from each tree, and the better the quality of the fruit.
Right.
Now you're asking the delicate question, how many trees makes for a really viable situation, and which is the low number you shouldn't go down below to
right.
keep getting good fruit. Now you say there are 3 different varieties. Are the pears shaped differently?
Yes, I've noticed several differences in the varieties. One, I think, as they ripen is red, so
mm-hmm.
it's a red pear. There's another that's a smaller fruit that's very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a third variety. They're almost shaped like grenades.
Right.
And they're not as sweet, and I can tell they're not as sweet because when they fall to the ground, I don't have nearly as many bees swarming around them.
That's interesting.
These trees have not been pruned in years and years and years.
Right.
So they're not particularly what one would consider pretty pears.
Gotcha. One of the things I don't want to happen here is for you to remove an important pollinator. So I think this winter you might want to thin out some of the overgrowth on these trees. And then in the spring, I want you to go out there and identify each tree. You know, give them an 1, 2, 3 or A, B, C kind of a thing.
Okay.
And I want you to mark the dates that they pollinate, that the flowers open and that the last flowers drop off. And then the trees you want to keep are the ones that are in the best cluster for their flowers being open at the same time.
At the same time, okay.
That's where pollination counts. When the flowers are open and your native bees are going back and forth from tree to tree. Now, if there's another tree that flowers very late in the game, and say tree A, B, and C, they're done. You know, they're already producing their little fruits. Then this late blooming one may have been planted with the best of intentions, you know, against a late frost, but it is not contributing to the number of fruits or the quality of fruits. The number of fruits and the quality of fruits are going to be determined by the trees whose flowers are open at the same time. And then if you find out that there's an amazing amount of crossover, that there's really nothing to be gained by that observation, then you get rid of the damaged one and the bad tasting one.
Okay. And do pear trees have to pollinate different trees in order to pollinate, or can they pollinate themselves?
I think
a lot of trees have to pollinate a different tree.
Even
I don't know about pears.
Trees that are self-pollinating, so-called self-pollinators, will produce more and better fruits if there are other trees that flower at the same time in the area. You always want multiple trees to get the most fruits and the best fruits.
Well, I think four of the trees are of the same variety, and two of those are the ones that are the smaller one and the broken one. So that would still leave me two of that variety and then one each of the other two, from what I can tell from just this season.
That would be ideal because, yes, you absolutely want a couple of different varieties in the mix.
Right. Okay.
All right, Richard.
I appreciate it greatly. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Keeping roots out of your compost to be. And because of the nature of the question, you're also going to get a crash course on simple layering. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, please read us this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. Bob in Portsmouth, New Hampshire writes, I have a compost bin made out of four wooden skids. I placed two layers of cardboard in the bottom last fall and filled it with leaves that I shredded three times with a bagging mower. But when I went to empty the compost into the garden this fall, I had forsythia roots coming up into the bottom of the pile that made things really difficult. What can be done to prevent this? It would be difficult to change the location, as it has to be placed out of the wife's sight as much as possible. Mike, forsythia is that plant with the really tall branches that produces all those bright yellow flowers in the spring. I thought it was pretty well behaved, no?
Well, it's a funny plant. It can become invasive, but not in any of the normal ways we think of. Mostly it's a clumper. The crown of the plant gets wider over time as it matures. But it doesn't vine, self-seed, or send up adventurous roots or anything like that. Instead, it spreads by what's called layering or pegging. Any branches that hang low enough to touch the ground will begin to root and form a new plant.
Like strawberries do with their runners.
Pretty close. Gardeners use a variation on this adaptation to propagate certain plants, like spirea, climbing roses, and of course forsythia. They'll clear an area down to bare soil, bend a branch down to the ground, and then they'll use a hoop-shaped metal pin or a brick to hold the branch in contact with the soil. Water that area a little bit every day, and the branch will send out a root. After enough time has gone by, you can sever the connection to the mother plant, dig up the new one, and plant it in its permanent location.
Neat. And that's called layering?
Well, technically, it's simple layering because there are four or five other kinds. So one answer here is to dig up the area under the bin, get rid of any existing roots, and then keep an eye on the mother forsythia that must be very close by. Keep any branches that are near the bin well pruned, and there shouldn't be any issues. I keep the bottom foot or so of my forsythia pruned to prevent them from layering their way into my house. You can also drive some edging into the ground next to the bin, just to be safe.
Don't we get a lot of questions about, quote, roots in my compost?
Yes, indeedy. It's a very common complaint. And if the plants in question can survive having several feet of material piled on top of them, cardboard ain't going to stop them. Cardboard works best to prevent regular weeds from sprouting up in freshly tilled soil, like when you build a raised bed. You till it all up, you lay cardboard in the bottom, frame it out, fill the frames with compost and or screen topsoil, and the cardboard down below will smother the baby plants that are going to sprout up from all the seeds you exposed and then replanted while tilling. But I wouldn't expect cardboard to be able to stop something big and woody.
So what would?
Wood would. I always like my compost bins to have ground contact so that earthworms can come and go and help the process along. So I wouldn't use anything that could exclude them completely. I'm thinking here a big wooden board, maybe a couple boards joined together and cut to size that you can drop on the ground at the bottom of the bin, making sure there's an inch or two of clearance all around on all the sides. Think of these spaces as bike lanes for your earthworms. A truly solid bottom will also be a bonus when you're battling a really tough plant trying to get in, like wisteria.
But wait a second, wouldn't the roots just come up in your worm lanes?
Well, they might, but they'd be really easy to pull out or prune when they're just on the sides. They wouldn't be one-tenth the annoyance of having them all through the center or the bottom of the pile. I also think we have to speed this pile up. Composting shredded leaves alone makes very good compost and is, in fact, the perfect imitation of how nature does this. But it takes a lot longer for those leaves to become black gold than if you had mixed them up with a high nitrogen source like coffee grounds, especially up in New Hampshire, where winter is long and cold and composting slows down, often to a screeching halt. Mixing in lots of spent coffee grounds as you build the pile will help it heat up faster, and you wouldn't have to wait a year to get to the finished material. And finally, I will suggest that the wife's visual objection is not to the compost itself, but to the sight of four pallets banged together. Perhaps our listener would have more wiggle room with his placement if he purchased one or two of those sealed bins made of recycled black plastic. They look pretty spiffy, and their cold chute-like doors down at the bottom make getting at the finished compost a lot easier.
And hey, the holidays are coming up.
That's right. Who wouldn't want a shiny new compost bin under the tree? Well, that sure was some good information about composting and plant layering. Now, wasn't it? Luckily for those of you who want more details, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes! My producer is threatening to plant bamboo under my bin if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please, please tell us where you live. Please, please, it's so important to us.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Adam Stan. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and get a fresh hit of You Bet Your Garden every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our well-layered staff includes editor Al Banks, production assistant Effie Kong, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm completely composted Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. What's the best way to store summer-blooming bulbs over the winter? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll properly protect your dahlias, cannas, and tuberous begonias, plus your fabulous phone calls.